Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Destiny Huff joins us to discuss being an educational consultant, neuroaffirming goals, and important things for parents to know about IEPs. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Destiny, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'd love to start off by learning, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
Yeah, so I am a mental health professional. I've been a mental health professional for almost 15 years. And when my son, who was undiagnosed at the time, entered into the public school system, being a mental health professional and having worked in schools before, early childhood setting and school settings, we knew about the perfectionism and we knew about the anxiety around that and some dysregulation, but we really didn't know anything outside of that. And we had a hard time. We're military, we're in an area with not a lot of resources. So we had a hard time really getting him in to see anyone anytime anything was going on. And it was just in like very sporadic. So we started school in the public school system and we started to have all these issues. And his teacher was really great, but administration kind of downplayed it until they did it. And they started to suspend him back to back to back. And during this time, there wasn't like, it wasn't safety concerns like he was harming himself or anyone else, but it was like, you know, throwing things in the classroom, right? Which someone could get hurt from that. But they were still not saying anything like to the effect of like how they were going to help him. And so me and my husband got a clinical psychologist and educational psychologist involved. And they immediately were like, have you thought about autism? And we were like, no, because I always say we had the stereotype view of like what autism looked like and presented like until I feel like most people do until you really have someone diagnosed with it. And so then he was formally diagnosed and then I started to research more. We always said that my son was two sons and we always say that my oldest, who's the one who's autistic, is just like me. And so then I started to do my own research, my own background, ask my own mother questions. And then I sought out my own diagnosis. So that's kind of a long way of saying how I ended up being introduced into the autism community through my son and then my own late diagnosis.
I always hate hearing about suspensions. It's like punishment, does that really work? And, you know, it's just so frustrating to hear about that.
Yes, yes. It was very heartbreaking. And the only thing that I did say is that because of it, I don't think we would have aggressively sought out support for our son had that not happened. And that's the only thing I say because we had already been like, oh, let's see about getting him some support here or there. When that started, we really were feeling like the child that they were talking about is not the child that we knew. And that was our concern, was like, why is he so dysregulated? Because again, I'm a mental health professional. Why is he so dysregulated in this setting? And that's what his therapist said, who helped us formally diagnose, get him formally diagnosed. She was like, if this is only happening there, we really need to look at what's impacting him there. But also, he's autistic, so we need to look at him getting support too.
Now, you are an educational consultant that supports parents of neurodivergent learners at the IEP table. So what do you think are absolutely critical things for parents to know about IEPs when they enter that room and are having, you know, these discussions?
I think the first thing is that the school does not diagnose, they categorize. And so I say that because I have a lot of parents who will say, well, my child's doctor formally diagnosed them with autism, but the school is saying they're not autistic. And the school does tend to say it that way. But what they're really saying is that based on our assessments we're giving and our criteria for that category of eligibility, because IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, every parent needs to know that. That's the federal law that governs special education in all states. They identify 13 categories of eligibility. And while autism is one of those categories, the child must check the boxes of that criteria. So just remember first that the school does not diagnose. So if your child has a formal medical diagnosis, or if your child gets the category from the school, but they have not been formally assessed outside of the school, then they don't have that diagnosis in that sense of like that medical support. And when we talk about disability services and supports outside of the school. The second piece is really making sure the school understands how autism presents for your child. So with my child, the biggest thing was because he's, and I don't use functioning labels, but because there was this thought of him being low support needs, aka high functioning, he asked communication. When he was dysregulated and couldn't communicate, then everything was a choice, right? Quote unquote. Like, he's just choosing not to listen. He's choosing not to do the work. He's choosing to melt down. And so I always tell parents, you really have to help the school understand, one, autism. And then when my child gets like this, they would benefit from this support. At least that's what I see at home. So really educating them on that. And then the other pieces that I notice a lot of times, autistic learners really need social emotional supports. And that is the biggest deficit I see in their IEPs, is that social emotional. So when we talk about IEPs, they tend to have social emotional, behavioral, and functional all together. So what that means is they start putting in like, will stay seated and will not blurt out answers and will follow teacher directions. And so really what they're saying is they're putting in that compliance, right? But they're not actually addressing like, if the child is getting up, is it because they need to move around? Do they need movement? Do they need sensory breaks? And that falls under social emotional. So making sure that your autistic child is getting the supports that they need to be successful and safe and comfortable in that environment.
Over the years, I've been in many IEP meetings. I've been invited by parents as just kind of a support person to, you know, be someone to bring because they know they can trust me. Nowhere near as educated on the IEP and these things as you, but I do have that experience of being in many IEP meetings. And one of the most important things that I think that can be done is to hear the student's voice in IEP meetings. I can't tell you how many IEP meetings I've been in and like, wait a second, this meeting is about this student and I literally heard this student for 3 seconds of a 2-hour meeting. So what things do you think parents can do to support their child being heard in these meetings?
So I'm a big, I always say, because the schools, so they have this little box they have to check, right? That says like, we review the IEP with the child, right? But a lot of times I'm like, okay, that's great. But like, did you actually include the child in the creation of the accommodations and the supports? And so one thing is I tell parents to always do is ask your child, like, for example, I did an IEP review recently, and the parent was like, my daughter's room, she hates graphic organizers. They do not help her. They do not benefit her when she's tried to work on writing her stories. And I was like, well, they need to know that, because that's an accommodation. And quite honestly, that is a common accommodation when our learners, whether they're autistic or ADHD, have any type of executive functioning concerns of writing, they're going to always say graphic organizer, because that's like what they've used historically. And it does benefit some. I have another learner who like, she needs that. It really helps her. But so I really think parents, ask your children. I always ask the staff at the table, like, have you sat down and talked with him and asked him? And I know when they're able to speak about my child's special interests, when they're able to say like, oh, he really loves this, and I talked about incorporating that, then I'm like, okay, you really did talk to him. And then as they get older, I recommend for parents to have them included in the meeting. One thing I tell my clients, depending on their age, is that if you have like really heavy stuff to discuss, like, you know, you don't want to embarrass your child, but maybe you're just like, they're in eighth grade and they're reading at a fifth grade level. Like, we need to talk about this. I always recommend that they have a portion where at least the child can come in and speak on their behalf and on what they need. And then that can be because, you know, they schedule the meetings for typically an hour when you really always like need to, but have the child come in for at least that time to be able to say what they need to say so they can get their input, and then they can leave, and then the team can discuss that heavy stuff that you may not want your child to hear. Because that's what I get from a lot of parents is like, I don't want my child to hear. I don't want them to think I don't think they're smart, but like they really need help in this area and I don't want to make it worse. So how can I include their voice?
Following you on social media, I've seen you post a good amount about neuroaffirming goals. What are the important principles you think that parents and school teams should think about in regards to these goals?
So the first one is recognizing that autism is a spectrum. A lot of times what I say by that is I notice that teens will kind of be like, okay, this child is autistic. This is their category. So they need these goals. And I always say it's similar to when a child gets an autism diagnosis. Almost every new parent I speak to will go, yeah, the doctor said they need 40 hours of this therapy, this therapy, this therapy, this therapy. And I'm like, that's kind of what they've been told can benefit. But we know that, like, and I say this as a mental health professional, 40 hours of any therapy in a week is just excessive and too much. One is recognizing it's a spectrum. The second one is when we talk about neuroaffirming, that talks about recognizing all parts of the learner, so intersectionality. What a Black autistic girl needs will be different from what a white autistic boy needs. You have to look at, you know, does their parent have, I have a lot of clients where their parents pay for private therapies and stuff to help support them, like speech outside of school. If school can't do like speech 3 times a day for 30 minutes, the parents aren't as pressed because they're like, my child's getting speech outside of it. What if the family can't afford that? So they're like, I really need the school to give them 3 days a week, 30 minutes of speech, you know? So intersectionality. Another piece is that honoring all forms of communication. So we know that there's limited communication. Autistic individuals, we know that it can happen even if they are very verbal. It can happen when they're dysregulated. So looking at other forms of communication, I know for my son, his special education teacher was able to use her phone one time and they were able to have a conversation via text. Like her handing him the phone and him typing in her notes. And that's how they discussed like what happened and like how he was feeling now and like what he needed to move on to the next step. So honoring that communication, whether they do gestures or sign language or they use an AAC device. And then when we talk about neuroaffirming, really focusing on not trying to take away the autistic traits. A lot of times the IEP goals focus on things that are not able to be helped. So for example, we shouldn't be having goals on stimming. We shouldn't be having goals on not engaging in echolalia. We should not be having those kind of goals. And what I always say is, because I always get the, well, what if they're unsafe stimming? Okay, that's different. And that focuses more on regulation and comfort. So what kind of goals can we come up with that can help them better self-regulate, co-regulate with someone else, and then have safety and comfort so that they aren't engaging in those unsafe stimming?
You know, I'm wondering about AAC in the sense that I've interviewed many non-speakers here on Autism Stories, and I'm wondering just your perspective of going to schools, going into IEP meetings, about where in general... I'm almost afraid to ask this question. Where in general do you feel like schools and school teams are at in terms of understanding the importance of AAC and other forms of communication that do not include like spoken language?
I don't think that the needle has been moved very far on that, to be honest. I have noticed where they're almost immediately receptive to AAC use or the limited communication autistics, but then they still don't have like the training on the buttons to use or the understanding of putting their gestalts in the AAC to further their communication so that they have that autonomy, right? Because their gestalt, a lot of autistics are gestalt language processors. And so having those gestalts and scripts that they can use, they still will use the AAC and maybe have statements and phrases that they think the learner should use. So I think that it's so much of a process forget recommending AAC if they could be verbal, then that's like a we're significantly limiting their progress. So I really think that there's so many layers to that. And I just think that they're so behind, because it has to be accepting the AAC and then actually trained on how to use the AAC and then understanding the full functionality and benefit of the AAC and then how to actually program appropriate things into the AAC and not using that as a punishment or taking away buttons when they feel like the child is misusing it. So like if the child needs a break and they're pressing break, 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 and you're irritated, they need a break. You would be irritated if you gave them one. But instead, the thought process is they're abusing this button, so we're going to take it away. So it's just,
yeah. I hear that. And I also hear from so many parents, teens, and adults who had IEPs, how their goals were definitely not neuroaffirming. So where do you think the biggest gaps still are in terms of educators making sure these goals actually are neuroaffirming?
Two things, compliance and not knowing what neuroaffirming is. I do many trainings and the educators are so excited to hear about it and to be like, what is that? Like, I want to learn more about it, especially when you start talking about the benefits of, like, a lot of times the reason why autistics can become dysregulated is because you have them focusing on that compliance and making eye contact and, you know, not stimming and not needing their sensory input and not trying to get dysregulated because of sensory input. Like, you have them do all these things that are unnatural for them. And so when you start educating them on neuroaffirming and you start telling them, like, these things help them be regulated, they're like, wait, so you're saying that, like, this setting could be more peaceful if we address this like this? And it's like, yes. Then they really want to learn about it, but they don't get that exposure. And then the other side of that is that education is just built on compliance. It is built on do what you are told when you are told. And I noticed that's why you'll see a lot of, like, neurodivergent educators and administrators that burn out, because they can't stay into the compliance because they're burning out trying to do that. And they see that their learners are struggling. And so they're burning out trying to support their learners and fighting against a compliance-based system. So I feel like the biggest gaps is really allowing PD on neuroaffirming and from lived experience. So autistics that can say, this is what my goals look like, and this is how it harmed me, and this is how it wasn't effective. And, you know, administrators and schools recognizing that compliance is not beneficial. And even if you have a child that's not autistic, when you look at developmentally, like how long they're supposed to be able to sit versus how long schools expect them to, it's just completely different.
Compliance is gross. I mean, it just really is. It's so gross to me. And I say that because for me, I've realized as I've gotten older, how old am I now? 45. I've realized that feeling safe is probably the most important aspect to me of my autistic experience. So how do you think IEPs can be written to reflect a goal of safety in a neuroaffirming way?
So the biggest thing I always say is when you get to know the child and that's written in there and you have supports in place that are reflective of the child, that's how they can feel safe. Like, so an example I give, my youngest child is not autistic, we believe he's ADHD, and they were writing a goal about, you know, basically like he will, when he's told to do something, he will do it. And I was like, no. I was like, because I want him to ask questions. Most importantly, I want him to say why he doesn't want to do it. I want to know. Because for him, he's very outspoken. And so he'll just say, like, because I don't understand him. But if you shut him down, he won't. And you'll just get these big responses. And so to feel safe, I think they really have to allow those sensory items, allow those sensory supports, allow breaks. Both of my children have scheduled breaks in their IEPs. And so they have that time regardless. It's not just like, and they have the ability to have breaks if they need them, but they also have scheduled breaks. And my son, who's autistic, he actually works towards those. Like, how he does it in his mind, he knows his whole schedule. So he knows when that break happens, this is what I'm going to do. And I made it so that they choose their breaks as well. So like, he loves Pokemon. That's a special interest. And so if he gets to play a Pokemon game, we provide the Pokemon cards and he gets to do a Pokemon battle. during his break. Those are all chances for the child to feel safe and understood, like you accept them, but also to decompress. And that's really what's needed for them to make it through. If you're like me, who doesn't have the capability of homeschooling your child, because that's been brought up a lot, ladies, just homeschool them. And I'm like, I don't have the capacity as an autistic parent to homeschool me, but also I work. So I'm like, I'm trying, that's why I became an advocate, because I try and find ways to make those environments safer for our autistic learners, for those parents that like can't. And that's what a lot of them come to me and say is they're like, Destiny, I can't homeschool my child. I'm a single mom, one income. So please help me, like, help her in the school.
And, you know, it's interesting because I think if, as a community of autistic people, if we were asked, and maybe not, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just thinking about myself, I kind of work towards my break every day. And, you know, I love what I do each day, love the opportunity to talk to so many different autistic people, but I'm also looking, very much working towards the end of that day. So I don't see what is wrong with working towards a break.
Right. And that's the big thing of, like, my son, like, he loves those breaks. And even when whatever is going on, like, he had got sick at school one day and the day was almost done, we had been having some stomach issues, so the nurse was just basically like, he can stay because I know it's not like a virus or anything. We just said we're just not sure what had been going on during that time. And then he was like, and my break's coming up at this time, from this time to this time. And so, like, we agreed because he wanted to stay because now he enjoys his school environment. And we're at a different school from the one where we had all the issues because we're military, so we moved. So he wanted to stay. And we looked at how he had his break. And of course, we were in agreement. Like, he can always come back to the nurse. I'll come gladly pick him up. Like, he wanted to stay. So, yeah.
As we've been talking, I'm wondering if I have trauma from going to IEP meetings because, like, I don't know, just this negative energy is bubbling up. I've always been so impressed, you know, with advocates like yourself that are really knowledgeable about things and going into these meetings. How do you not, like, how do you, I guess maybe, I don't know if it's burnout or just sometimes, like, not seeing the results that you want, like, in these meetings, like, these teams just not getting it. How do you kind of, like, navigate that whole process?
I think the biggest thing I always tell my clients, it shouldn't be like this, but a lot of advocates I know, we have had this effect on our side of that a lot of times because they are bringing an advocate. First of all, I've never seen so many district people show up to a meeting. And now there's, like, every meeting I've been to, there's been a district person because they're bringing an advocate. But I think the thing that unfortunately, fortunately benefits my clients is because I am a mental health professional, a lot of times when I open my mouth, I get that respect of being a professional, right? Like, because they're like, you're a professional in a field. And my background is working with children. I'm a certified trauma therapist for children. And so they're like, oh, so, like, we can't treat you like you don't know what you're talking about, right? And it's like, it shouldn't be like that. And I've been on the other side where, as a parent for my own child, while we were seeking out support for him, they're literally looking me in my face telling me my child is oppositional defiant. And I'm like, I'm a mental health professional, you are not, that is not correct. Like, and they're just trying to basically gaslight me and tell me, like, well, you're a parent, so maybe you don't see it. No. So I think that professional piece really gets it. But I still also, like you said, so because I run my own schedule, I make sure when my clients are like, hey, when can you do an IEP meeting? I think I've only had 2 days now this whole time over this past year where I had 2 IEP meetings in a day. But that's one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Usually I only do 1 IEP meeting a day if I have one in a day. And I typically don't do more than 3 in a week. Because it is draining. It is draining because you're going into a social situation. They sometimes are, like, super smiley, but then they're also like, you're an advocate, we don't like you. So, you know, you're stepping into that. But like you mentioned, like my husband said, he said I made autism and special education my special interest. Anytime there's something I don't know, I immediately look it up. So I know when we go in the meeting, unless they're throwing curveballs, and because I do all my meetings virtually, I do my meetings for my sons in person. They're both in special education. I do those in person, but for my clients, they're all virtual. So I think that being in my own space keeps me feeling safe and comfortable. Being able, if they mention something that I'm confused about, I kind of have the ability, right, to look it right there up on my computer. So all of those things make me more comfortable and not feeling like out of my depth in my zone when I'm advocating.
And lastly, Destiny, how can our listeners learn about you beyond this interview?
My website is Destiny Huff Consulting. And then my Instagram is DestinyHuff_IEP_advocate. I pretty much push everything through there. But I also have my Facebook, which is Destiny Huff Consulting. So some stuff from my Instagram goes through there. I find Instagram to be an easier platform for me personally to navigate. So even though I know it's part of Meta with Facebook.
Well, Destiny, I really love the conversation. Thanks so much for making time to talk with me today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much to Destiny for the conversation. To learn more about Destiny and her educational consulting, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for our autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts. Experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients, then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories. And if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.